Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It was Kansas City's pivotal year, 1940. As FDR won his third term in office and the Nazis rained bombs on London, Kansas Cityans finally ran Tom Pendergast's corrupt political machine out of power. The city's notorious nightclubs closed. The city government was bent on cleaning up the town, known as the Paris of the Plains. John Simonson tells a story of 1940 Kansas City in his new book, Kansas City, 1940, A Watershed Year. John Simonson is a writer and editor. His local history blog, Paris of the Plains, became the basis for his book, Paris of the Plains, Kansas City from Doughboys to Expressways. And John, welcome. So good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, let's begin by talking about the inspiration for this book, John, because there are these photographs of Kansas City that were taken by the Works Projects Administration. That's FDR's famous program aimed at creating jobs during the Depression. Talk to us a little bit about these photographs. How did you come across them to begin with?
Well, I came across them, as many people do, while I was doing research in the history of my house. This was probably 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They used to be kept in the Landmarks Commission at City Hall. And it's a collection of more than 40,000 images. What they told you at the Landmarks Commission at the time was that they were probably taken in 1939, 1940.
Mm-hmm.
Most likely or definitely the result of a tax reassessment.
Mm-hmm.
And the story was that over the years, they became lost and they turned up in a dumpster. Hmm. Someone recovered them from a dumpster. And
well, thank goodness for that, you know.
Really?
Or you wouldn't have had a book.
Exactly. Well, the folks down there didn't have much of other than that for a backstory about where these came from or even when they were taken. So a couple of years ago, they were moved over to the Kansas City Public Library downtown in the Missouri Valley Special Collections,
mm-hmm.
and prepared to be digitized and made more accessible online.
And somebody's actually gone through all these things and digitized the entire collection, right?
That's right. They've been scanned and digitized. They're actually available now on a different website. I think the Missouri Valley Special Collections website is being updated, and they'll be on that eventually. You can access them now through the library's blog.
And we're talking just about Kansas City, Missouri homes, right? The suburbs, like the one I live in Westwood on the Kansas side, they're not included as part of this thing, right?
That's right. At the time, it was the entire county, Jackson County. But what survives is just within the city limits of that time, which was the Missouri River to basically 77th Street and the Blue River to State Line.
Huh. So when you saw these photographs, John, did sort of the light bulb go off and you began to think to yourself, there's got to be something more to do with these?
Well, they were interesting to me because there were buildings in them that probably don't exist, or images of the buildings that probably don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. The buildings themselves definitely don't exist, but there may have never been another picture taken of it,
mm-hmm.
that survives. Early on I had the idea that this would be a good project of some kind, a book project. But it wasn't until just a few years ago that it actually came together.
So how did you wind up picking the particular photos that you wound up using for your good book there?
Well, as I said, there were more than 40,000 images.
Yeah.
My publisher, the History Press, would probably not allow that many
you wouldn't
to be
think.
Used. So I had to be selective.
That'd be one thick book, John.
Actually, the limit was between 60 and 70 that I could use. So it was a tiny fraction, of course.
I was going to say.
I knew there were some sort of iconic images that we had to use, City Hall, 1908 Main, which was Pendergast's headquarters, Union Station, that sort of thing. Those definitely had stories to go with them.
Mm-hmm. So you end up telling the story of Kansas City 1940 through these 30, 40, 50 photographs you end up including in the book here.
Yeah, there's actually 64. And, as I said, there's several iconic images that carried their stories pretty obviously. when I was researching, I had to go back and look for information on the actual tax reassessment to determine that it was 1940 and these pictures were taken that year.
Mm-hmm.
So in doing that, I basically just read newspapers from the entire year. And in doing that, I ran across lots of little interesting stories that sort of filled out the big picture of 1940.
And if you set the table for us here about 1940 Kansas City, an incredibly important year. Again, at the tail end of the Pendergast era, Tom Pendergast is in prison. He comes home in 1940 to his home on Ward Parkway. And the city is really going through a extremely significant shift at that point.
Right. I think the way I put it in the book was that it was a time between a sinful past and an uncertain future.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of uncertainties in the world at that point, of course. It turned out that there were lots of what I thought were kind of significant events that suggested this was a year of a turning point.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the headline event was the electoral ouster of the machine from city government.
Which was a huge push by the White Hats to get Pendergast out for good. Lots of moms got involved with that campaign.
Right.
And it was, again, one of those defining moments of our town.
That's right. He, of course, had gone to jail the previous year, 1939, for income tax evasion. He was in Leavenworth at the time of the election. So his people were still on the city council, and this was what the election was about. The reform government led by Mayor John Gage,
mm-hmm.
His subsequent hire, L.P. Cookingham, as city manager,
right,
were the leaders of the reform movement that took over and basically changed just about everything about how people thought about Kansas City. They were most concerned, of course, with the cleanup at City Hall, but there was a companion cleanup, physical cleanup of the city as well.
And jazz clubs and all kinds of crazy things happen at night. All that stuff, at least most of it, went out the window, right?
The governor of Missouri, Governor Stark, the previous year had begun closing down. He was really incensed at some of the things that were going on in the notorious mm-hmm. nightclubs here and began closing them down for things like liquor violations, revoking their liquor licenses and things. And many of them did close and never reopen.
Yeah.
There were a few that survived. Lots of times jazz people talk about how the city just dried up in 1940, but there were remnants that continued on, and some very important jazz was still being played here.
We'll talk a little bit about that, too. You know, one thing that surprised me in here is that as you talk about 1940, Harry Truman is up for re-election to his U.S. Senate seat. Lots of suspicion even then, 1940, with Pendergast in prison and coming out, that Tom Pendergast was still pulling strings for Harry to make sure he won his re-election bid.
Yeah, and the Pendergast people denied that. His nephew, James, was still running the show down at 1908 Main, but they denied, and I guess I've read that there really wasn't much evidence that TJ up in Leavenworth had much to do with what was going on.
You wonder, though, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
You always wonder. Well, you open this book, John, with a section about your maternal great-grandparents and how your great-grandfather actually disliked the WPA and the entire New Deal, for that matter. I mean, you don't hear about opponents of FDR's administration too often, but clearly, as evidenced by your own family, they were out there.
Oh, yeah. In fact, my family is representative of a huge swath of Kansas City that didn't have anything to do with jazz clubs or any of the nightlife. The things that have survived is sort of the boilerplate history of that time, I guess. They were Christian Scientists and, you know, didn't drink or smoke, and it wouldn't have been caught dead in a jazz club. But they were definitely there, and they had stories to tell. And one of them was, you know, the wee piddle around thing about the WPA. They didn't like that.
Yeah.
But there were lots of them just like that, too.
You know, lots of folks, as I talk about it on the show from time to time, know that I have an abiding, enduring interest in jazz. And, you know, what struck me about your book, there's a photograph of of what's now a parking lot immediately east of City Hall, directly behind the police department, not City Hall. And I used to park there every morning when I first began working at the Star. They hired me as a police reporter. And what struck me about your book was that same lot was where the Reno Club was and some of the great jazz clubs in this town, where some of the all-time greats spent a lot of time playing: Charlie Parker, Ben Webster, Count Basie, and a bunch of others.
Well, Count Basie was the house band there before he was called away to New York and big time jazz. It's probably the best known of the clubs in Kansas City jazz history. And right behind that was a little sandwich shack where musicians would hang out on their breaks, and a lot of the great stories got told there, too.
And it's amazing that something like that was right next door to the police department.
There were other similar clubs hard by the police station as well. Dante's Inferno, the second iteration of that place, was actually closer than the Reno Club was.
Yeah. Hey, how many of these buildings, just roughly, that you chronicle in your book, Kansas City, 1940, A Watershed Year, how many of them are still around?
Oh, in the book, you mean?
Well, just roughly, yeah.
Maybe half. I mean, there are some of the private homes were, and some of the commercial buildings as well, were victims of the clear cutting that went on for the expressways and traffic ways that got built later on.
Yeah.
So whole swaths of those neighborhoods are gone. But probably half of these in the book are still here.
I should point out that John Simonson will be talking about his book, Kansas City 1940, at 6:30 on Tuesday, April 29th at the National Archives. To make a reservation for this free program, just call 816-268-8010. Again, 268-8010. How tough was it to research all these addresses and come up with what you came up with there?
I wouldn't call it tough. That was actually the most fun part for me. I really enjoy the research. It was a little bit labor intensive. You had to, as I said, either know what your building looked like when you went to look for it on these sheets that the little thumbnail size photographs are put on.
Yeah.
Or an address, and then if you know how the system works on those photographic pages, you start at the northeast corner of a block and go around clockwise.
Uh-huh.
So you had that. You have what they have at the Missouri Valley Special Collections is a really wonderful collection of Sanborn fire maps, which were made for firefighters to know what sort of structures were in place. And they have the actual shape of the structure and the address that you can sort of cross-reference. And then you have, you know, the city directories and the telephone directories. When you're doing this kind of research, it's almost the same as if you were doing research in your family history, because you use the same resources for that.
And you can find out stuff like what by doing all that?
Well, you can find the exact location of a building that way.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing city directory stuff, you can find, what jobs people held. I should mention one of the most valuable resources I had was the 1940 census, and that came out just 2 years ago, just about right now.
Yeah.
They have to wait 72 years to release each full census for public use. But when that came out, I was able to read exactly how many people lived in a particular place and the occupations of the various members of the house, the ages, you know, just all sorts of information about that filled in a lot of the
holes.
Material.
Yeah. Well, you know, the photographs that you show, all of them feature a worker, a WPA worker, holding up a sign with a series of numbers on it. What did those numbers represent, John, as you look at those photographs?
It just represented the location of the building, what lot it belonged to in the city, and what parcel number it was within that block.
Yeah. Let me give our listeners an example of some of the stuff you came up with. Let's sort of skip through here and go to 604 Winchester Avenue. Mm-hmm. This is your story of the Contreras family, and this was a family that relied on ice deliveries every summer to keep their food cool. Tell us about them.
Well, it was a little shanty, really, that was right across the street from the Sheffield Steel Plant. And a lot of the neighborhood residents were immigrants, many Mexican families. And this particular family had maybe six or eight people living in what looks like, you know, a three-room house.
Mm-hmm.
They were on the list for Penny Ice. The Penny Ice Fund was something that the Kansas City Star and the Salvation Army had been doing for years and years.
Because folks didn't have fridges.
Refrigerators were a luxury still for particularly families like this. So you had an ice box or some other way to keep it cold, but a truck would come by weekly, I think, and make various planned stops on corners, and people would show up with their little red wagons and whatnot to carry a big block of ice home to keep whatever you had it cool at home.
And as the workers sort of cut that ice up, all the dogs would come out from the neighborhood and sort of lap up some of the shavings from the ice were flying
fringe
all over
benefits.
The place.
Yeah.
And the Contreras family was a family that relied on that ice coming by.
That's right. And there were stories about people that had been Penny Ice patrons for years and years.
Yeah. Well, if our listeners know of a Kansas City address from 1940 with a good story, you can call us. Or if you want to ask John Simonson a question about Kansas City in 1940, give us a call, 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888. Let's go to a very prominent Kansas City address here, 5650 Ward Parkway, which in 1940 was the pretty much of an empty home of a gentleman named Tom Pendergast.
Yeah, people are probably familiar with that without maybe knowing what it was. What it is.
Who lives there now? Do we know?
I don't know. I do know that it's on the market for something like $3 million. But
well, I'll have to just walk by and take a look at it right for the show. I might want to pick that one up. Yeah,
one of the stories that my my Republican family used to tell. You know, they always called him Mr. Pendergast. They had respect for him, nevertheless. Was that, you know, common on hot summer nights, people would get in their cars and go for a drive to get cool.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the places they would drive would be up and down Ward Parkway. And specifically, they'd drive by this house to see, just to look at it and stare and wonder what was going on inside.
Yeah.
The Kansas City Public Service Company, which was a streetcar and bus company in town, opened that year a new service, which was an open-air streetcar that sort of was available for tourists, and you could hire it for special parties and things. And it traveled all over the network of tracks all around town giving these tours, and that was one of the highlights for the streetcar called the Scout. It was called the Scout. People would drive by or ride by very slowly and stare at Pendergast's house there in Ward Parkway.
So what was going on with Tom Pendergast in 1940? You describe his situation a little bit in the book. And again, these descriptions you have of each of these properties is fairly brief and fairly concise. So you can get a pretty clear snapshot fairly quickly here. But Tom Pendergast is, you know, by what, April or May, early part of the year, he's home from federal prison. His kids are long gone, and he and his wife are sort of alone in that home, and they ain't getting along too well either, are they?
That's right. He's not feeling well physically. He's got some heart problems.
Heart problems, yeah.
In fact, I think this is around the time they installed the elevator down at 1908 Main, so he didn't have to use the stairs. But he's basically here alone. After he gets out in early May, I think he got out maybe 3 months early for good behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's really not able to negotiate the stairs there very well either. And I think his son eventually set him up in a bedroom downstairs, so he didn't have to do that. But it must have been very lonely for him to be sort of rattling around in this place, which apparently he didn't enjoy as much as the home they lived in originally over on Wyandotte Street.
You can only imagine it. And again, you write about this in the book, this idea that undoubtedly Tom Pendergast would have spent time looking out one of his windows as those trolleys and buses came by just to and watch people staring up at his home, and he'd be staring out at them, and kind of a lonely vision there.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I sort of do this in a few places. I sort of put myself there and imagine what was going on, and I can definitely see him looking back at these folks that are staring up at him.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, and our email address, updateatkcur.org. Well, let's talk about 1908 Main Street. And I got to tell you, I'm embarrassed to admit, as the political guy for this, for our newspaper here, you know, I've walked by that building, 1908 Main, the site of Tom Pendergast's, you know, very famous office back in those days. Looked up those steps. I've never been up there. And I've always wanted to get up there to see what that room was like.
Yeah, I have too. I actually know some construction guys that were doing some renovation work on that place for the owner recently, within the last year or two.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think they've kept some of the details, some of the woodwork and things, but most of it is very different. Yeah, that was ground zero for political control in Kansas City for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you went to get your favors. You lined up on the mornings that he was there pretty early and just stood in line and walked up the stairs as he handed out the favors. And he didn't really linger very long over anybody. He just decided if he was going to do it or not.
And what you'd pay for a recording of one of those mornings today, what that would have sounded like. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We have a tweet of appreciation from Leslie who says, these photos were so fun for people in Squire Park, Kansas City. Such a treat to see how the homes and streets looked back then. Where is Squire Park?
I'm not familiar with Squire Park.
I'm not either. Yeah, well, I appreciate the tweet from Leslie here. Let's go to Ruth Ann from Kansas City, Missouri. Ruth Ann, good morning.
Good morning to you. You were just talking about the open-air streetcar in 1940, and I wanted to comment that all streetcars in 1940 were open-air cars. You just lifted the window yourself if you wanted to.
That's right.
And took the streetcar line to the Swope Park line to Swope Park a lot in those days because it was cool out there. And there was a lot going on, including the lagoon and the bouncing bridge that you could walk across. And let me see, good swimming pool, and also the line that the either side of the streetcar in which you could sit, you could lean out either side and touch trees that were leafed out.
Hmm. Sounds like you've got some good memories of doing that, Ruth Ann.
I do. Listen, Marlboro, you were talking about, Kansas City went out to 70th. And that was Marlboro, which was lovely and green and wide open. I had an aunt who lived out there, and she had pear trees, and we went out and ate green pears out there.
Sounds lovely.
Sounds great, Ruth Ann. Thanks so much for the phone call. I appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
Yeah, bye-bye. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a lot more history of Kansas City in 1940. We'll talk about City Hall, the police department, 526 Westport Road, the home of Sawyer Material, which sold building supplies and also a whole lot of coal. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about politics and about whether Hillary Clinton is inevitable or not as she considers a race for the White House in 2016, we talked with Carl Cannon and David Von Drehle, two terrific journalists. You can find it at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, our indie foreign and documentary film critics join us to talk about the latest film showing on area screens. This hour, we're talking with John Simonson. He's the author of Kansas City, 1940, A Watershed Year. Brian McTavish coming up in just a little bit with our weekend to-do list. We'll also have the latest edition of A Fan's Notes with Victor Wishna. Again, John Simonson with us now, and he'll be speaking in just a couple of weeks, Tuesday night, April 29th at the National Archives, 6:30 in the evening. To grab a seat, call 816-268-8010. Again, 268-8010. That event is free at the National Archives on Tuesday evening, April 29th at 6:30 in the evening. Lots of phone calls for John. Let's go back to some calls now. Keith from Liberty. Keith, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to let you know that the Antlers Club, which was owned by the Pendergast family and where they lived for a bit, at least the mayor did, where Charlie Parker played a lot of jazz, is still in existence. It's on East 12th, just off State Line, right there in the Bottoms.
Huh. I did not know that. I'd like to see that someday. John, you familiar with that?
I am. A couple of summers ago, I had a chance to work in what's called the Paris of the Plains Cocktail Festival. Presented a little bit thing of history of jazz clubs, and I did come up with that information about the Antlers Club in the West Bottoms on 9th Street. It's actually it's the only remnant of what used to be called the wettest block in the world, when everything down there was a bar. And it was owned by the Pendergast brothers.
The wettest block in the world. I like that.
Yeah. And it's been bars over the years. It was for sale the last time I looked not too long ago. But it's not right now. I think it's for lease. So if anybody has a really good idea for something like that down at the Antlers Club, that would be cool.
All right. Keith, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Let's go to Pat from Overland Park. Pat, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you for taking my call. What role did the Savoy play other than having a booth for President Truman?
I've sat in that booth myself, Pat. Absolutely. The Savoy, its place in local political lore here, John.
Boy, I come up blank on that. I know the Truman story, but beyond that, I really don't have any stories.
Yeah. Sorry about that, Pat.
Thank you.
You bet. Let's move on here. 414 East 12th Street. This is City Hall, John, mm-hmm. and lots of stuff happening at City Hall in 1940 Kansas City. Like what?
Well, of course, that's the center of city government, aside from 1908 Maine, I guess. But that's where Mayor John Gage moved into the large space vacated by the previous city manager, Henry McElroy, who had been indicted for embezzling city funds and had died the previous summer. Mayor Gage moved into that after the election in April and began the reform movement.
Mm-hmm. And what a huge movement that was. There's lots of determination, I'm sure, lots of eagerness to sort of change the whole culture of Kansas City pretty quickly, too, right?
That's right. One of the major impulses that year was to finally put into play the elements of the 10-year plan that never got built. The 10-year plan was the bond issue in the early 30s that gave us the new city hall, mm-hmm. the new county courthouse, municipal auditorium, the Brush Creek concrete project.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that didn't get built or even started was the system of traffic ways that the city felt it needed, sorely needed. And so,
lots of concern about Southwest Traffic Way, about Boulevard 2, how that was going to shake out, right?
Right. Well, there were lots of Southwest Traffic Way was, I guess, the priority.
Mm-hmm.
There was supposed to be a Southeast Traffic Way as well that would cut roughly down 27th Street toward where the stadiums are now.
Yeah.
Of course, Southwest Traffic Way was built, but not until 1950 because the war put off all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Southeast Traffic Way was never built as planned, but it did become part of what is now I-70.
We're talking about the history of Kansas City in 1940 with John Simonson and his new book, Kansas City 1940, A Watershed Year. I should point out the history of Kansas City places continues tomorrow on Central Standard as Monroe Dodd takes a look at Troost Avenue. That's tomorrow at 10 on Central Standard here on KCUR. How about across the street from City Hall, John, 1125 Locust, headquarters of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, some of the same sort of thinking, sort of clean up the mess thinking going on at the police headquarters, just like there was going on at City Hall.
And the man in charge there was a guy named Lear B. Reed, who had an FBI background and was kind of known as a heavy-handed enforcer type. And he announced early in 1940 that Kansas City was now a viceless town.
Mm-hmm.
kind of incredibly because we know that it wasn't. But
and he took the vice squad away, right? Actually disbanded it.
Well, he felt it wasn't needed anymore. That's right.
Man, just like that. Boom.
Right. But he had been on the job since the previous summer, and he would only last another year or two before he moved on. But in the time he was here, he really came down on a lot of things. Some people felt a little too hard on some sort of trivial things like fireworks and too much emphasis on people speeding and things like that.
Yeah. Where did the name Paris of the Plains come from, this notion that was our moniker back once upon a time?
Right. That's been kind of elusive, but I have kind of tracked it down. Of course, there were other journalists that made reference to Kansas City as sort of a Paris because of the sin industry here. That was
not because it looked like Paris, but because of the sin.
That's
right. Yeah.
And of course, back then, I guess people associated Paris with sin. We don't really they didn't really think of it the way we do maybe now as something
artistic.
Like,
yeah.
As Midnight in Paris by Woody Allen, but. Mm-hmm. Then it was all about sin, and those references first, as far as I can tell, were made in about 1938 by a journalist from Omaha, Edward Morrow, not Edward Murrow, but Edward Morrow, and almost exactly the same time by a conservative syndicated columnist named Westbrook Pegler.
Mm-hmm.
They both likened it to Paris, and I found during the war, Pegler came back to kind of check up on Kansas City after the reformers came in and found it to have turned over a near leaf and referred to it then as the Paris of the Western Plains. So the Paris of the Plains was picked up kind of interestingly by John Cameron Swayze, who was actually a resident and a working journalist at the Kansas City Journal and on the radio here in the 30s. And in 1958, I believe, he wrote the liner notes for a jazz LP from Capitol called KC in the 30s.
Uh-huh.
And in that, he mentioned that Westbrook Pegler had called it the Paris of the Plains. So I think that's where it all came from.
Oh, that's interesting. Back to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Scott from Prairie Village. Scott, welcome to the show.
Right. I'm interested in a great large dance place, which was a big famous place on Main Street between, say, 32nd and 33rd Street on Main Street that had the big bands all the time. Really good music there. It like Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller, Harry James, Artie Shaw, and people like that. And that was big time in 1940. Why have you not mentioned or talked about something like that? It was a great dance place there.
All right.
Yeah. Well, we're going to mention it right now. It was called the Playmore. And a lot of people have great memories of the Playmore. It wasn't just a dance hall, although that was probably the feature. It had a huge grand ballroom where all these bands that you mentioned would play. They also had 34 lanes of bowling. They had a swimming pool. They had an ice rink in the back where the local minor league hockey team played in winter, and just lots of different amusements there. It was quite a place. It was kind of the wintertime. It was an all-year place, but it was kind of what people did in winter where maybe in summer they went to Fairyland Park.
I hope that helps, Scott. Appreciate the phone call. Yeah. Let's continue looking at some of these different addresses around town. Let's see. How about 526 Westport Road, John, the home of Sawyer Material, which sold building supplies, and it also happened to sell a whole lot of coal?
Yeah. Well, coal was, of course, a common element around Kansas City. Houses burn coal for heat. All sorts of apartment buildings, commercial enterprises burn coal, which, as you might imagine, created a lot of coal smoke and soot, and, mm-hmm. and the soot would show up just about everywhere in people's houses, on clotheslines. It was kind of a nuisance. There was actually an ordinance that was not enforced very often that this year people decided was more important than it had been treated, and they started enforcing the rule when companies' smokestacks put out more smoke than they were supposed to be doing.
That's interesting. So too much smoke sometimes.
Too much smoke.
Yeah. How about my home away from home, the Kansas City Star Building, 1729 Grand? And as you point out in this book, John, a whole lot more going on at 1729 Grand than just newspaper work back in 1940. Lots of radio stuff going on there.
Yes, of course, the Star had WDAF radio at the time, and they had studios within the Star Building and two giant antenna on top of the Star Building as well. So they would have national broadcast hookups through WDAF, and they would, they also had an in-facility studio with, with studio audiences coming to watch various game shows or symphony performances and whatnot.
Yeah. You also talk about, 1912 Main Street, where a man named Robert Richardson thought he had a solution to traffic congestion.
That whole block of Maine, of course, that's where 1908 Maine is, and that was a very interesting block. Across the street was the Midwest Hotel where Robert Richardson lived, and he ran this little candy shop, just a little shack, really, in the parking lot that now exists between, in the middle of the block, basically. That's going to be developed, I understand, pretty soon. But his solution to traffic congestion didn't have anything to do with expressways or streetcars. He wanted to build a subway from downtown out to Marlboro, the neighborhood the lady was previously mentioning, which he thought was doable with a cigarette tax. One of the consultants that the city fathers called in to talk about traffic problems pointed out to him that it actually costs a lot more than that, and cigarettes weren't probably going to be able to pay for a subway.
But the whole notion of developing highways, lots of plans are being made in 1940, but again, no interstate highway through Kansas City at that time. This is pre-Interstate 70.
It is. This happened to be, you know, the time of the New York World's Fair, the 1939-1940 World's Fair. And one of the most popular exhibits there was the General Motors building, which had an exhibit called Futurama, and it was a diorama, a big diorama, built with General Motors' version of what the world of 1960 would look like, and that was all about multi-lane freeways full of cars. There were no streetcars or buses in that world. Barney Allis, of all people, the man who was behind the Hotel Muehlbach at that time and a big downtown force, decided that Futurama was for Kansas City, and he drew up his own, what he called Futurama, which was basically a freeway, eight-lane freeway from roughly the plaza to downtown, right down Main Street, and it would circle downtown as a kind of a loop. Well, you can see now that we do have a loop. It doesn't, it doesn't send multi-lanes to the plaza from there, but
how that would have changed things if that thing had gotten built, right?
Exactly. It was. It would have required clear-cutting basically Main Street from what we now know as Crown Center to the river.
Yeah. Well, John Simonson, again, his new book is Kansas City, 1940, A Watershed Year. What a pleasure to have you, John. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.